This is KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
Early voting in the Texas primaries kicks off in about a month, and to help you figure out what kind of politician you'd like to vote for, KUT is going to explain just what the different statewide offices do. Today, in the first part of our Get to Know Your Statewide Offices series, KUT's Ben Philpott looks into the powers of our chief executive by taking a trip back to the creation of our state constitution in the 1870s.
It was a time of rebirth in Texas. Or maybe more precisely, a time of getting rid of those daggum carpetbaggers from Reconstruction.
When the North sent folks down to Texas to govern, you know, as governors, Texans felt like these king-like people came down from the North and ran roughshod.
That's Sherry Greenberg from the LBJ School of Public Affairs.
So when Texans wrote the Texas Constitution, it's a very populist document with as much power as possible vested in the people and at the lowest, most local level of government.
Of course, it wasn't just Texas. University of Texas Law School professor Hugh Brady says decentralizing government power was a broader trend across the country in the 19th century. But here in Texas, the idea left us with what's considered a weak governor.
Now, the Constitution says that the governor is the chief executive officer of the state of Texas, but what does that mean? And for over 100 years, it meant very little.
Are you kidding? There's so much even a weak governor can do. Former state budget writer Talmadge Heflin helps us run down the list.
When there's a need for a special session, the governor has a responsibility of calling that and setting the agenda.
Hey, that's a pretty good power. It allows governors to push their legislative items to the front of the legislative line by forcing lawmakers to take action on a limited agenda. Hugh Brady, what you got?
He used to have the constitutional power to call out the militia in case of an Indian raid.
Okay, that's interesting, but not culturally acceptable.
And we removed that in 1999.
Well, that's good. Way overdue, but good. Anything less awkward?
He gets to appoint the Secretary of State, who keeps the state seal.
Huh, that's something. Let's check back in with Talmadge Heflin.
The governor also is required to produce a budget. Not one that the legislature will pick up and do anything with, but the governor does have to produce a budget.
Well, that just seems like an exercise in futility. Having to put together a budget only to have lawmakers ignore it?
But the strength of the governor, I think, when it comes to the budget, is that there's line item veto power.
Hey, a real power. That veto threat means lawmakers can't get a budget passed to the governor if he or she doesn't support it, because the governor can veto large chunks of the budget and then call a special session to have them write it all over.
And then many of the powers of the governor, I think, come from the ability to our responsibility of appointing many, many positions within state government, within agencies.
And bingo, there's how former Governor Rick Perry transformed the office from weak to strong. You see, the state constitution originally set the governor's term at only 2 years, but the term for appointed state agency board members is 6 years. Even after a 1972 amendment that made the governor's term 4 years, that still meant any governor would have to serve a second term just to start gaining a controlling share of the various state boards. But stay in office more than 14 years, like Governor Perry did, and you can make every single appointment to every single board. Which meant when Perry left office, he took that power with him. And while Governor Greg Abbott has begun to make some headway into those appointments during his term in office, he doesn't have nearly the power Perry did. And if someone other than Abbott were to win the governor's race this year, they'd be all the way back to square one. Ben Philpott, KUT News.